an amazing place full of wonders, and science can enhance our appreciation of those wonders if we manage to maintain a sense of wonder ourselves and keep on asking those questions. Keep on asking. Just sound. Sorry. Do I need this? Do I need this? Can you hear me? No? Do I need it? Can you hear me?
Better with it.
Better with it. I may just have to shout.
Can you switch this one on and then she can use this?
Hello. At least our speaker will be heard. So one of the driving forces behind the development of our knowledge of science is the constant development of new techniques, new tools. And they help us look at the world through the lens of science. And that is the objective of this course, is to ask five different lecturers from different disciplines of science to address interesting questions about the world and reflect that back into how we see ourselves today. So this is not just a theoretical lecture series. We hope that it will have really good applied lessons that you'll find interesting in the way you look at the world. So our five sessions will be on looking back into the past, looking at the Earth from space, weather patterns, climate change, and so forth, looking down at the very nature of matter, looking at atoms, looking at particles, and then standing on Earth and looking out into space, in a sense, looking into the future. And so this is going to be something of a journey, and our first guide today is Dr. Riyash Nasifuddin, who is an archaeologist. She hails from Tonga in KwaZulu-Natal, where she was brought up, but she did all her undergraduate and postgraduate studies here at the University of Cape Town. And she's now currently a lecturer in the archaeology department and in earth and biological sciences. And she is going to introduce us to our ancient ancestors and see what we can learn from them about ourselves today.
When compared to these Neanderthals on the left, they're generally what we call more gracile.
I like to think of it as the difference between what you would expect a rugby player skeleton and a ballerina skeleton. Right? Robust versus rather gracile. And in the skull morphology, we can see that the modern human, again, is a little, looks a little bit smaller. It lacks this occipital bun that we call that at the end of the Neanderthal skull. It also has a much higher forehead. The forehead goes straight up. The case is a little bit rounder. And more importantly, and very distinctly, we have this prominent chin. Now, modernity is not just defined physically. Modern humans also display some pretty novel behaviors. And the debate continues about which of those behaviors are uniquely human. You hear about studies of primates learning to use tools and that kind of thing. But most scientists will agree that by 50,000 years ago, our species was definitely and habitually engaging in the full suite of modern of behaviors that is particular to humans. The combination of things like language, art, and developing complex technology. Now, at the risk of oversimplifying what is being done in the field, I would say that the big questions of modern human prehistory are, who is a modern human, so both physically and intellectually? Where do we come from? When did we emerge on the landscape? And also why? Now, by this I mean why evolutionary processes led down one road instead of another. Now, the methods used to answer these questions can be broadly classified into one of four categories. There's the primatological approach. Now, this is a study of our closest living relatives, and it's used to understand the evolutionary context and processes that have led to the emergence of modern humans. So these kinds of studies would be things like studying altruistic behavior in chimpanzees. It would be studying cognition. You see a lot of articles about chimpanzees learning to play games. We're trying to understand how the mind works. We learn about how they make tools. Are they able to use abstract ideas to further their own ends? So that's what we call the primatological approach. My own research, which looks at the Southern African Chapman lagoon, I try to use genetic approach to try to understand how landscape has shaped primate populations in the past. So that's another level at which we can use these primates, and it's not just chimpanzees. We can be using all kinds of primates. Now, the paleoanthropological approach is one that most of us think of when we think about the study of human evolution, and this is the use of fossils. This is where we dig something up and we want to understand who this individual was, where they came from. We use the fossils to reconstruct that evolutionary history. And the other is the population genetic approach, which uses, well, I should say the population approach. And what that does is it uses modern populations, the variation in what we look like, the variation in our genetics, the structure in our genetics, to try to understand past population processes. And that's the thing that I will get to quite late on in the lecture. And finally, there is the archaeological approach, which of course is digging things up and trying to make sense of the cultural and faunal, by faunal I mean animal bones, the cultural and faunal deposits. Now, there are basically two competing models of modern human origins. I'm sorry, that's not very clear. But essentially, the dominant one is this out of Africa model. And what you're looking at here is we have a species called Homo erectus, which you may have heard of. And basically, the idea of this model is that Homo erectus went out into the world, but left a population behind in Africa. Then what happened is over time, those species continued to evolve into what we call archaics. This is in different parts of the world. And then finally, what happened is these modern humans, something that was very different, evolved in Africa through a series of events. And when that species was so successful, they were then able to leave Africa, even though it was cold, they had fire, they had the tool technology, so they were able to leave abundant, warm Africa. And as they spread out into the rest of the world, they basically outcompeted everybody else. They took over. So it's also known as the replacement model or the recent African origins model. Now the second model, which was largely laughed off when it was first introduced, but is becoming more and more acceptable with the genetic evidence that we're finding, is this one of multi-regional theory. And what multi-regional theory says is when Homo erectus left Africa, it went out into the rest of the world and of course evolved as separate discrete populations, giving rise to all these archaic species. These species that are sort of on the edge of being modern but not quite. And what happens is that as these species continue to interact through interbreeding, as a global species, as it were, gave rise to modern humans. So there's the influence, all these different geographic regions in our own modern evolution. Now I'd like to move to a brief aside and talk a little bit about modeling. This is a technique that is being used more and more, not just in the paleosciences, but all sciences. And you'll be hearing that term, statistical models, modeling climate change. You can hear about climates. So I just wanted to sort of break down what we mean when we're talking about climate. I'm sorry, about modeling. Now, when we generate a hypothesis of human prehistory or of any phenomenon, natural or otherwise, we cannot account for every variation or exception. So what we do is we build models to explain what we think happened. So models are necessarily oversimplified, a version of reality. So it's a reduction of that reality into a set of what we call parameters. And these parameters are different variables that we think, I'll get to an example, but these are parameters that we think are the best at describing that scenario. So, for example, a very simple example. We want to model who we think will attend this lecture next year. What do? We look at the group of people here today, and we decide which variables best describe this group of people. It would be gender, race, age group, educational degrees, how far in your education you are. Now, when we want to model expectations for next year's group, we can put all those parameters in, but there's no way of accounting for every variation in each of our histories that has brought us to this place in this time, right? So that's what a model is. It's simplifying and to the best of our ability, trying to define the parameters that explain the scenario that we hope to understand. So some of the parameters for modern human evolution would be things like time. We want to know how old the Homo sapien lineage is. We would like to know where they were distributed, right? So what environment do they live in? Where did they come from? So geographic distribution would be that parameter. Another parameter that we might seek to estimate is what they ate, right? We would like to average out what kind of diet a certain population had. And then the other thing that we can do today is we can estimate things like population size and population interbreeding. So we can estimate population dynamics. So you can start to see how by taking all of these different... Oh, this feedback. We start to, by taking all these parameters, we can start to build this necessarily simplified, but a model of what we think modern human life was like. So the study of recent human evolution focuses on the transition between fossils, which we refer to, like I said, as archaic humans. Now these are individuals that have similar brain sizes to ours. They had some of our morphological characteristics, but also a lot of differences. And then we are the fossils of anatomically modern humans. So we're looking at the transition between the archaics and the AMH, the anatomically modern humans. A variety of fossils have been found that date between about 200,000 years to about 30,000 years. So those individuals over there. The oldest fossils showing modern human characteristics are found in Africa and date to about 130,000 years ago. And the oldest related modern human fossils outside of Africa are in the Middle East. Those date to about 90,000 years ago, and they turn up in Europe and Asia by about 30,000 years ago, 30 to 50,000 years ago. Now, one of the first questions any paleoscientist asks is when something happened. This line of questioning can be relatively simple. I say relatively, it depends on the complexity of your strata. So here is a geological cross-section, and you can see these nice geological deposits. An archaeological deposit can often look very much like this in that you have one deposit, one deposition, the people go away, they come back, they leave another cultural layer, they go away, they come back, they leave another one. And so eventually what you have, if you're lucky, are these horizontally layered strata. And so in answering the question of time, you can simply, more simply, look at just what came first. You can look at, is this older than that? Is that older than that? And by extrapolation, whichever artifacts are in those layers are then the bottom ones are obviously the oldest, and the ones at the top are obviously the youngest. And here's the geological time scale. Now, the geological time scale, I've only given you the names of the different periods and epochs. But that's what that relates to relative time. I thought there were dates on there, but there aren't. What that was supposed to say was how many millions of years ago that was. And that's what we refer to as absolute time. So absolute time is when exactly something happened. And that's what I want to talk to you a little bit about, the methods that we use to construct absolute time in the past. Now, some of the elements that we can use to construct time in the past are things like uranium, potassium, rubidium, and carbon, and these are some of the more common elements used in radiometric dating. And what radiometric dating is a reliance on the fact that things like isotopes, let's get back to that, okay? So there's this naturally occurring, we're going to focus on carbon. We know that carbon is naturally occurring, and it's found in a wide array of organic and inorganic materials, right? So we have wood, charcoal, bone, which are of course organic, but we also have carbonates, things like stalagmites and stalactites that form in caves, which also contain carbon. How does that work? Okay. So I apologize if this is oversimplistic for some of you, but basically all elements have what we call protons, neutrons, and electrons, right? An element is made up of, is defined by its number of protons. So here we have carbon, 6, which means it has 6 positively charged particles. It also has electrons, and that's less important for what we want to talk about here, but it also has these neutrons. So neutrons are neutral particles, but they have a lot of weight. So they are essentially what gives the atomic weight to our element. So these elements, as we know from the periodic table, exist, but they also exist in different forms. Like I said here, the number of protons is what defines that element. But you can have the same element, same number of neutrons, but with different numbers of same number of protons, but with different numbers of neutrons. And that's what we call an isotope. So it's each of two forms of the same element, same number of protons, but a different number of neutrons in the nucleus. Now, when this happens, it makes certain elements unstable. Existing in these different forms makes them unstable or radioactive. And that's really good for us. Okay. Just a few more terms that we need to just bear in mind is that when we have the original element, it's called the parent. This is usually the unstable one. And when that parent decays, it gives rise to these daughter products. Now, the rate at which a parent goes to daughter is something that is constant. It is experimentally known. And it, as far as we know, is not affected by things like pressure, the amount of water in the system, temperature. And this rate is known as the half-life. So half-life, essentially, is how long it takes for 100 atoms of the same element to be reduced by half. Of the parent element to reduce to the daughter by half. So by the end of one half-life, you have 50 of the parent and 50 of the daughter. And then over time, the parent continues to reduce and the daughter continues to rise. So the half-life is the amount of time that it takes for that to happen. And with the technology that we have today, we can measure either, depending on how much of the element is there, we can either measure how much radioactivity is being given off, or we can measure the actual ratio of parent to daughter. And by doing that, we are able to construct these graphs which tell us how old an object is. So we take the object, we take a sample, we either measure the radioactivity in that sample, or we measure the carbon-14, for example, versus carbon-12. And by doing that, and knowing experimentally how much we should have in modern human bone, for example, we can determine how old that individual is most likely to be, at least in time, not its actual age. So isotopes are very, very useful. They can also be used to tell us something about what people were eating. So in this case, we use more stable isotopes and not the radioactive kind. In biological systems, we take in our carbon, we take in our oxygen, we take in our nitrogen through food. And that food becomes a part of who we are. We make muscle, we make tissue, we make teeth. And what happens is that every organism that eats or drinks then becomes a walking data point of what types of food were around when they were alive. So although the process by which this is absorbed into tissues is not necessarily that well understood, we do know experimentally how one intake of carbon-12, a particular ratio, then what we call fractionates into tissue or bone or teeth. It does it at different rates in each of those different tissues. But that is known. So this consistency allows us to be able to determine, for example, if we have an animal that could have eaten C4 grasses, that could have eaten grass, or could have eaten leaves, we can tell which of those things that animal was preferentially eating. And in doing that, it is able to tell us a little bit, again, also about environment. So was there more grass or bush in the where that animal lived? The other thing that nitrogen in particular can tell us is about where your protein comes from. So you may have read a little bit or know a little bit about this idea of hunter-gatherers. Did they live by the sea? Were they consuming a lot of seafood? Were they moving seasonally? That kind of thing. And actually, it's the protein in their collagen, in their bone collagen, that allows us to determine whether most of their food is actually terrestrial or marine. So that is how we are able to start to reconstruct diets. Besides actually finding the butchered bones of animals in an archaeological site, we can also use the bone of the humans themselves, bone, teeth, and collagen, to reconstruct diet. So we leave diet there. We'll talk a little bit about reconstructing environments. Now, it was James Hutton that stated that by understanding the present, we can understand the past. This is a concept known as uniformitarianism, which is used in many sciences today. A lot of possibly younger students don't realize they're using it, but they really are. It's a geological principle, but essentially we compare what we know about how processes work today and we extrapolate that understanding to samples from the past. And this is usually what we call a proxy. So that is a proxy. A proxy is an indicator of some variable from the past. So it's not an actual, you can't go back and measure the temperature. You can't go back and measure the amount of precipitation. But you can take a sample from one of these types of cores and get a proxy, a stand-in for an environmental for environmental variables. So at any site, archaeological site, the environmental context is reconstructed using several lines of evidence, which I will go through. So isotopes are a great proxy for the reconstruction of regional and global environment. What you're looking at here is, this is a stalagmite, and this is a marine ice core. What they have in common is that they're each laid down in layers. Now, much like I said, when an organism consumes food or water, it's taking on, it's becoming a walking data point. It's actually consuming the amount of carbon, 12 versus 13, it's consuming the nitrogen, 14 versus 12, at some rate that is exists in its environment. In the same way, when the isotope, when these layers are laid down, they also capture environmental signature. So this is made of carbonate and water, for example. So it has oxygen, it has carbon, and it's taking those on to create this calcium in the same ratios that they exist in the environment. And at the not wanting to get into it in too much detail, what these carbon ratios and oxygen ratios can tell us from experiments that we've done today, from collecting cave water samples today, is that it can tell us at what temperatures these things were laid down. It can tell us at was it more likely to be drier or wetter because of how much dust we have in the ice core, for example. So by taking these different signatures, we're able to reconstruct curves of temperature and precipitation change through time. Cores like these are more useful for these larger geographic regions. So what archaeologists do, my desk is all washed up. What archaeologists do is they turn to more local signatures of habitat reconstruction. One of those methods is something called zoo archaeology. Now, in zoo archaeology, we use the bones of animals, which are found at different sites, to reconstruct the animal community in an area at that point in time. So once all the bones are collected, they collect all the bones, and then they sort them out into their different species. If they can get down to species level. You might be at the family level because the bone is too fragmented, or you may only be able to get to the genus level. For example, you can only tell, all the antlered, the straight-horned individuals from the others. But a really experienced formal analyst can do a lot more than that. They can usually get all the way down to species level. And once they've done that, they create these species assemblage. You're essentially creating the biodiversity index at some point in the past, right? So what can that tell you? Well, if you've got a lot more grass eaters than you have leaf eaters, you can make a case for saying that there was possibly more grass around this period. Why is that important? Well, what grass tells us is that the region, especially if it's different from today, say it's a forest today, was once cooler and drier. So that's what that tells us. So we can able to extrapolate these species assemblages into the past and tell us something about what the habitat looked like. Now, like I said, I brought in uniformitarianism, so I should point out why that's important, is a lot of this work is based on comparative collections. So we collect bones. Every time we find roadkill, we bring it up to the department. Every time someone culls an animal somewhere, you are lucky if you can collect it. And so we build these comparative collections. So we use our modern collections to try to associate which of those bone fragments most likely to be this organism or that organism. And that's something we call comparative methods. Another comparative method that's used for reconstructing environments is palynology. So palynology is the study of pollens. So these are pollens on the electron microscope. And basically, people that know, not me, other people, are able to determine whether the pollen is from grass. They can tell you whether it's from a fern. They can tell you if it's from a tree. And this is just one method in which the plant species assemblage can then be reconstructed. So you can start to see how these different lines of evidence can come together to give us a really good picture about what's happening at the site. Again, this is a comparative method. We use modern collections. We use modern collections to determine which those species most likely, what types of species those fossil pollen most likely represent. So that is another way of doing habitat reconstruction. So there are, these are the three methods that I mentioned. So there's isotopes, there's zoo archaeology, there's palynology, but there's a significant number of other methods that are used to reconstruct both habitat and diet. But I don't want to go into those today because I'm running out of time. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the genetic data, which is a little bit up, more up my alley. And it's also more topical because it's one of the more recent ways in which we are able to reconstruct modern human origins. So I want to talk a little bit about mitochondrial Eve, famous mitochondrial Eve. And I want to talk about how this all works. So when we look at genetic data, so genetic data is a sequence of A's, G's, C's, and T's, what we call nucleotides. And it's kind of like reading a language. When you start to sequence data, you're basically reading the DNA. And what happens is when we find two individuals, we take any two individuals in this room, and I can guarantee you at some point in time, we can trace back a common maternal ancestor. That's what the sequencing of mitochondrial Eve has done. So basically, this, mind you, is one of the most probably one of the most controversial bits of genetic data that has come out. When we are made, basically what happens is you have all these little sperm cells that go up to the egg. And what the sperm cells do is they use up all their energy. So by the time they get to the egg, all their mitochondria has died out. Okay? So essentially what's left when a zygote is formed is your mother's mitochondrial DNA, because the egg retains the mitochondrial DNA, and that is why we say that mitochondrial DNA is maternally inherited. It's passed down from mother to child. This is what we call a uniparental mode of inheritance. And what's really useful is that it's much easier to model statistically, this uniparental mode of inheritance, but it also has obvious limitations. It only tells us one side of the story. But this didn't stop the people that came up with this hypothesis in 1987 when they looked at mitochondrial variations in people from around the world. Like I said, any two people will have a common ancestor sometime in the past. For example, so this is a very simple phylogeny or a relatedness. So individuals 1 and 2 share a common ancestor, and they all share a common ancestor with individual 3, but much further back in time. So that's basically how these genealogies are reconstructed using these different types of DNA. And when they did this for all modern humans, they were able to ascertain that mitochondrial Eve, or the human maternal ancestor, existed at about 200,000 years ago. Now, mitochondrial DNA and DNA generally is another type of clock. Okay? Mitochondria changes, or DNA changes over time. There's constant mutations. Those A's, G's, C's, and T's are constantly changing. This is tolerated when that DNA, when those changes are happening in what we call neutral DNA, non-functioning DNA. We can allow these changes to happen. And these changes are happening at a more or less known rate, okay, with the
with a lot of exceptions, but let's work under the simplistic assumption that we know that. So if we know how many mutations happened, and we know how long it takes for those many mutations to happen, we can work back and determine how long ago the ancestral lineage was around. So that's how we did that. But of course, once this came out, the controversy was that, well, clearly we are all African in origin, okay? But the multi-regional theorists would say that actually, looking at other lines of evidence, more recent lines of DNA, we can actually trace different genes to different parts of the world ancestrally. And so we haven't really honed in on that question yet of whether we are actually all just African in origin. Now, given the interest in mitochondrial Eve, of course, men have been in on the act, and scientists turn their attention to reconstructing Y chromosome Adam. So like we only get our mitochondria from our mothers, we only get, or men only get their Y chromosome from their fathers. So women are XX, men are XY, so the Y chromosome is only passed down from father to son. And so necessarily we're actually losing a lot of information. So when they reconstructed genetic ancestry with the Y chromosome, the dates for the common modern human ancestor came out as much later, 60,000 years ago. There's lots of reasons for that, which we can talk about if you would like. Okay. So the other interesting finding that has come out of the genetic data is the idea that we actually emerge from a population of about 10,000 people, according to the DNA. Like I mentioned, DNA is constantly mutating, and that means those mutations accumulate over time. But those mutations can also accumulate depending on the size of the population. If you have 100,000 people, you're going to have a lot more mutations through random processes than you are if you have 10,000 people. But if you have 10,000 people and a lot of time, you can also generate as many mutations. So what scientists said, given the amount of variation that we see in modern humans today, and knowing the time frame that we have to work with, is that actually anatomically modern humans were probably only about 10,000 that then dispersed to the rest of the world. And again, the out of Africa group would stress that this really supports this idea that a small population left Africa and then went out into the rest of the world. But more recent genetic data is starting to question this idea of out of Africa model. And I said that multi-regional is starting to take over, into better reputation now, but not entirely, and this is why. So in 1997, the mitochondrial DNA was extracted from a specimen of Neanderthal from Germany. And when they compared the mitochondrial lineages as they go back in time with modern humans, what they determined was that Neanderthals are actually about as different to modern humans as the two chimpanzee species are, for example, the bonobo chimpanzees and the regular chimpanzees. So those are different species. And so scientists that said that then, of course, we are different species. Remember, Neanderthal only became classified as Homo relatively recently. And there's been some debate about whether they were the same species, was there interbreeding going on. But in 1997, the data that came out suggested that no, there was no interbreeding, and in fact, we were different species. However, in 2010, the full genome of Neanderthals was released, and it has actually been shown that non-African populations, so populations that are non-indigenous to Africa, actually share about 1 to 4% of their DNA with Neanderthals. So what does this tell us? Well, we know Neanderthals are an Asian and European archaic home, right? It tells us that there was very likely to have been some interbreeding Once modern humans left Africa and moved out into the rest of the world, there was some interbreeding going on with the archaic local variables of species that existed. And this is not surprising. It's been late into coming into anthropological genetics, but in many other species, we find species that have been separated by 2 million years of evolution that happily interbreed on contact. So biologically, it's unlikely that this wouldn't have happened if it was possible. So that is the Neanderthal question. And this idea is now being supported by more recent evidence coming out of Eastern Siberia, out of Eastern Europe. It's something called the Denisovans. So you may have heard about this, it's been in the news a lot lately. So the Denisovans are a species of hominid that has been shown to be both distinct from modern humans and Neanderthals while being contemporary. So they existed at the same time, but they were very different, they are definitely different genetically from modern humans and Neanderthals, except that they seem to have left their genetic mark in Southeast Asia. So what this says to us is that it's possible that there should be a third model. As with most things in science, once we have more evidence, all polarities have to reach a compromise. So we have one model versus the other model, and now what's becoming more and more clear is that actually what we need is a third model. And this third model that has been growing in favor is one of assimilation. And it suggests a mixture model. Okay, so assimilation says modern humans, yes, they left Africa, it may have been a small population, but once they moved out into the rest of the world, they were able to interbreed with local populations. It may have been males taking females or some variation of social dynamic. And slowly but surely outbred the local variants, but some of that genetic signature of these archaic homo remains in our genome today. So the idea is that we are all mostly African, but not to forget that these different local variations do exist. Diversity is a spice of life, I'm told. So I will leave it there. So that's where we stand in terms of modern human origins, and I hope that I've shed some light into the big black box of paleo. Prehistory, and I will take any questions. I think I went a little fast, so you might have a lot of questions.